You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of September 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Burgess Watson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, from miniskirts to headscarves, Egyptian State TV's first veiled anchorwoman takes to the airwaves, attracting media attention across the globe. We head to Cairo to ask, is this the face of things to come? And a high-stakes love triangle. The French president promised voters to be plain old Monsieur Normal, but two new books about François Hollande's private life paint a very different picture. Plus, how have maps shaped history?
We're suddenly travelling outside of Europe and we're discovering new places, so we need some way of recording how to get back to them. And of course, the map is the perfect object to do that.
We've got all of that, plus some great music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's get a wrap of the world news with Jonathan Wheatley.
The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said today that China and its neighbours in Southeast Asia must move determinedly to draw up a code of conduct to help resolve disputes in the South China Sea. Clinton, visiting Indonesia ahead of a trip to China on Tuesday, said she would tell Beijing and other claimants that it was essential to get faltering diplomacy back on track and move towards a deal as soon as possible.
The United States does not take a position on competing territorial claims over land features, but we believe the nations of the region should work collaboratively together to resolve disputes without coercion, without intimidation, without threats, and certainly without the use of force.
A 15-year-old Dutch boy has been sentenced to a year in juvenile detention today for stabbing to death a 15-year-old girl whose Facebook posts reportedly led to a contract for her killing. The case, known in the Netherlands as the Facebook murder, caused widespread debate about the role of social media in violent crime. A court in Arnhem has given the maximum juvenile sentence to the boy for stabbing the girl to death. The details of the killing, ordered and planned by the victim's best friend and her boyfriend, after a dispute on Facebook, have shocked the Dutch. Peter Moore, the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross, will begin a visit to Syria today and will hold talks with President Bashar al-Assad to try to improve humanitarian access to civilians in the war-torn country. The ICRC spokesman, Hicham Hassan, has said in Geneva.
Discussions will mainly be about the obstacles that we are facing today with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent as well, to perform our humanitarian services within the country, all over the affected areas like Aleppo, rural Damascus and other places. But it will also talk about the ICRC's priorities for the coming period and to build on what was discussed previously during our ex-president in Syria.
Some of the 270 South African miners charged with the murder of their 34 colleagues after a violent clash with police last month have arrived at court today ahead of their release from jail as the government attempts to reassure investors. A minister in the government, Collins Shabane, stressed that the Lonmin Platinum mine events had not impacted the government's ability to attract investors. The chief representative of the Economist Group has said that Europe's muted economic growth will affect Asia. Major Asian economies like China, Japan and South Korea have increased extra spending or lowered lending rates in an attempt to counter the negative impact of Europe's debt crisis and the global downturn. However, according to Xu Sitao, it doesn't seem to be enough of a buffer.
European debt crisis has been affecting China, but I think a significant impact on China's real economy actually beginning to emerge in recent months, as evidenced by quite atrocious export data in July. I do expect equally negative trade data in August and September.
And finally, losing your sense of smell could be a blessing, particularly if you work for the sewage industry. But for most people, it's a curse. However, gene therapy could be the answer, after tests on mice showed it could reverse the effects of congenital anosmia, which causes the dysfunction from birth. The treatment involves regrowing parts of cells found in other organ systems which have not been affected by mutation which causes the disease. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
I'm sniffing, Jonathan, because that last story makes me think how sad it must be to lose your sense of smell, because it's such an evocative sense, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
And smell takes you back to chapters of your life past, doesn't it?
I remember chocolate being a strong smell as a child, and toffee, Welsh toffee, being made for me by my grandmother.
I read an article on the way here actually saying one of the most typical smells of England, which is where we are now, is the smell of clipped lawn. After a mower has been over.
Unless you get hay fever.
Yeah, that's not quite such good news, is it?
But I agree with you. The smell of fresh grass is a wonderful smell.
It is indeed, a very British one. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobropa Jalavert, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is indeed Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. Now, it's not every day that the attire of a TV news presenter makes the headlines around the world, but Fatima Nabil, who's an employee of Egypt's state broadcaster, has done exactly that by wearing an Islamic headscarf. That's something that would not have been permitted under the rule of the country's strongman of 30 years, Hosni Mubarak. Well, to tell us more, we're joined from Cairo by journalist Abdelrahman Hussein. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. Lots of media attention surrounding this story here in Europe and in the United States. What's the situation there in Egypt?
Plenty of media attention here as well. I mean, it is an event. I mean, you'd think that this shouldn't be such a big deal, but it is a big deal in the context of the change in the dynamic of power in Egypt, and now that the Muslim Brotherhood has ascended to the presidency. And the supporters of such a move feel that it is a breakthrough because for 30 years, Mubarak, actually this is the first time in the history of Egyptian state television that a newscaster reads the news with the veil on. And Mubarak, there was like an informal, unwritten rule that no veiled newscasters would be present on Egyptian television. So for the supporters, it's a breakthrough in that, finally. And for the opponents, it's a worrying sign of things to come.
Speaking of things to come, do you think we can expect other female news presenters to follow suit?
I think so, yes. I think we will be seeing more. I mean, we should be clear about something. This is not the first time you see veiled news presenters on Egyptian television. I mean, private television, satellite channels, there are some. Even Arab news channels. So it's not exactly a new thing, a new phenomenon. But it's just, it was the symbolism is very strong because it was Egyptian state television and that hadn't happened.
Indeed. And it is a big change, isn't it, from decades past, because in the 1970s, perhaps even in the early 1980s, a visitor to Cairo might have expected to see ladies in miniskirts. But several years now, that has been a very rare sight, isn't it?
Well, this is also a very interesting dynamic because you're correct. I mean, Egypt does have a secular past and a secular history born from Abdel Nasser and his avowed opposition to all Islamist factions and what they represented. It's true that you won't see this in the streets in Cairo. You will see it. It does exist, but just it's not as ubiquitous as it once was. But what's interesting about this latest move is that because there's so much inbuilt opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood and their rule, it is actually also pushing people to kind of sort of oppose it, and that expresses itself in things such as dress codes and so on. So while you will find for every one new veiled presenter on television, you might find 10 girls who will take off the veil. So it's a bit more complicated and it's a bit more nuanced than just what you see on television, and it's a societal thing, and the implications of it we'll keep seeing it as the political ramifications sort of have this interplay with Egyptian society.
And speaking of politics, of course, the presidential elections were massively divisive there in Egypt. It was a razor-thin majority that brought Mohamed Morsi into power. So there must be a large number of people in Egypt today who are somewhat disenfranchised with the current leadership.
You're absolutely correct. There's a huge polarization. We haven't seen this before. But of course, we've never had free and fair elections before, so that it probably makes sense. But yes, there is. He barely made it to the presidency. His rival was a man entrenched with the old regime, and there's also the third faction of revolutionaries and revolutionary candidates and all that they support. So there's big polarization, and there's much sort of, if not at least overt antagonism, but at least deep concern about the rule of the Brotherhood. And there's a lot of people within Egypt who are concerned about that, They are more likely to kick up a fuss whenever there's sort of these overt kind of overt incidents that kind of imply that the Brotherhood rule is becoming more and more entrenched, kind of keeps on happening.
And it's absolutely essential, isn't it, for the Brotherhood's survival that they get it right, because this could be their one chance, because, of course, they were banned under Hosni Mubarak. This is their chance to show the Egyptian people what they're capable of doing, and they really have to think everything through, presumably very carefully.
Exactly, and we do have to make a distinction between the Brotherhood and, say, for example, Salafi movements who are more religious and who kind of push for the more religiosity in public life. The Brotherhood aren't really like that. The Brotherhood are pragmatists, and they know very well that this is their one chance. They are in a better position now after consolidating power and removing the two top army generals, Tantawi and Anen. And since then, it's their playground now, and they're free to do as they want. But they do know that they have to be very careful, and they have to weigh up every move before they do it.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about other aspects of life in Egypt, not just headscarves and the transition from miniskirts to headscarves. Has there been a notable shift in attitudes across Egypt in other aspects of life since the fall of Mubarak and the arrival of the Muslim Brotherhood?
That's actually interesting. In the day-to-day events, nothing. I mean, I don't know what to tell you, but for all these people who are worried about this Islamization of Egypt once the Brotherhood swept into power, it did not happen. It hasn't happened. That doesn't mean that it might not happen in the future, but there has been absolutely no change whatsoever in how people live their life at all. I have to be honest about that.
All right. So perhaps some exaggeration on the part of the international media about this headscarf turning point, as it's been called in some circles. Perhaps it's nothing more than a small step in a direction that the country isn't necessarily taking altogether. But we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, Abdulrahman Hussein in Cairo. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this.
Monocle 24 is growing. We're proud to introduce The Stack, a new program on air every Saturday. This lively one-hour show is a celebration of the print media, exploring the best in periodicals, niche journals and newspapers, and talking to people from around the world who are pushing the sector forward and shaping the media landscape. Running on Saturdays at 10 a.m. UK time and repeated on Sundays, the show is an intimate conversation around a coffee table stacked with interesting magazines and newspapers from around the globe, hosted by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brûlé. That's The Stack, every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. UK time, repeated on Sundays and available online. Brought to you in association with J.Crew.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design proud of its provenance.
It is coming up to 6:15 in the evening here in London, 2:15 in the afternoon in Rio de Janeiro, and that's, we're going to head to Brazil, in fact, now, because barely a day goes by without talk of the economic successes and the newfound political clout that Brazil seems to have. From cattle farms to oil refineries, steelworks to textile manufacturers, some say that the world's newly crowned number 6 economy could soon be in 5th position, perhaps even by the end of this year. But there's one area where things don't seem to be taking off in quite the same way, and that's Brazil's airlines. The airline Gol seems to be hemorrhaging cash and is sinking under a heavy debt burden, the largest, in fact, of any airline relative to its profits. Well, to tell us more, we're joined by Guilherme Amaral, who is a Brazilian lawyer who specialises in aviation law. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Now, is it fair to say that Brazil's airlines don't seem necessarily to be delivering what we might expect this number 5 economy in the world to be delivering?
No, actually, we in Brazil, we are facing a very complicated moment in aviation. We are seeing a new project to the airports, and airlines are not actually ready to deliver what we expect at this point. So we've been seeing a lot of trouble with them.
And I think it's fair to say that there's huge scope and huge potential for the service on board a Brazilian airline to be about the best in the world. You know, Brazil's flag carrier ought to be the BRIC airline. Why isn't it?
Actually, we have 200 million people that are not even used to fly yet, and we don't have well-structured air transportation along the entire country. So we have a lot of potential and still a very, very small market in the country. So most of the companies we are seeing right now operating in Brazil are new companies. We have TAM, Gol, and companies with not more than 10 years in this kind of service, and more, you know, the older companies and the big ones are bankrupted and are gone. So actually what we see now is that new companies are trying to deal with a whole new market. We are not actually ready and mature to know how to deal with it. And we have a new service being provided and still a lot of new passengers arriving. And most of the time what we see is that we are not as safe as we would like to be to international crises, and we are still depending on the price of oil. And we can't see in Brazil a safe way to say that companies are going to offer the same service and keep the same results for more than 1 year.
And yet Brazil is the manufacturer of the world's third largest aircraft, the Embraer. So how is it that, you know, Brazil's managing to get the construction of aircraft right, and yet the service delivery on the airlines not so right?
Embraer is like a very great example of the possibility of Brazil developing new technologies here. But it's actually awkward to say that we have that in Brazil. And now, since 2 years, we have our first national carrier using Embraer aircraft. So the fact is we have a huge aircraft manufacturer here in Brazil, but national carriers didn't use to fly their aircraft until Azul, which is the company founded by David Neilman from JetBlue from New York. And now they are actually operating Embraers in Brazil. So the fact that we have a good industry developing new products and selling aircraft around the globe is not actually connected to the quality of the service we have been providing both in domestic and international flights. We do have a lot of new regulations and a lot of to learn with this market in Brazil. But so far, it's still quite complicated to run an airline in Brazil. And most of the carriers that have tried to didn't succeed. So we have TAM for a long time now becoming the biggest national carriers, but still far away from what Varig was as a flag carrier flying around the globe with Brazil's name. And we have Gol flying domestic flights, and now we have some regional carriers trying to increase their participation on the market. But this is not really connected to what Embraer has done in technology and developing new products that are being sold all around the globe.
But it almost seems the other way around, that Brazil should have been able to produce aircraft almost before its own domestic and international commercial aviation sector really took off itself.
Yeah, it seems so. And the fact is, Embraer has been selling private jets, and now they are increasing their production on commercial jets. And this was actually more for exports, and now we are starting to use those aircrafts in Brazil. But I think Embraer was, from the beginning, based on private jets operation, which is also a huge market in Brazil. But for commercial flights, we were not that used to see Embraer planes around.
And you talk about the largest airline there in Brazil, LAN, the Chilean flag carrier, took over TAM, which was already the biggest airline in Brazil. Is there a sense that perhaps LAN did rather well out of that deal?
Actually, our feeling is that the way they told the market that this was happening is just that they were merging, and that LAN and TAM would be run together, and part of the board would come from TAM and part from LAN. The fact is, TAM was not strong enough and wouldn't be capitalized enough to face all the international competition we are facing right now in Brazil. And the idea we've seen right here is that we will have headquarters in Chile, and LAN is going to bring a lot of the professional administration we haven't seen in TAM for a while. TAM was more a family company trying to understand how it grew as big as it is right now this fast. So what we expect is that we will have some more professional administration, but we are still seeing TAM in Brazil as a Brazilian company, and it is still being treated that way. So our feeling is not that we don't have TAM anymore and now we have LAN in Brazil. It's actually the fact that they are merging their operations, but we still have two different airlines flying here.
All right. Guilherme Amaral, Brazilian lawyer and aviation law specialist, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. It's 22 minutes past six in the evening. Do stay tuned. Now, the Paralympics are, of course, in full swing here in London, as well as the archery and the various other events that have been taking place in the swimming pool. There's been one other thing very much on the lips of everyone there at the event today, and that's, of course, the outburst of Oscar Pistorius, the man they call Blade Runner, on his competitor yesterday, his competitor from Brazil, Alan Oliveira, who Pistorius says won because his artificial legs are longer than they should be. Well, it's all overseen by the International Paralympic Committee, and strict regulations surround the games. And Oliveira says that everything had been agreed with the referees, and Pistorius has now apologised. Well, to tell us more, we're joined by Ken Hurst, who's the technical director of the 2012 Paralympic Workshop, and he joins us now live from a workshop, in fact. Hello, Ken. What sort of things are you working on right now?
At this present moment, we're working on three of the Swedish team who have brought in their wheelchair rugby chairs, which have taken a considerable beating. So we've got quite a bit of welding repairs to do to them. And generally, we've got a very, very busy workshop this afternoon for right across the board. All the nations are coming to see us, and mainly with wheelchair repairs this afternoon, yes.
And you do some of those repairs actually on site, don't you? What sort of things typically go wrong?
Typically, it's the balance of the wheels at the front or the large wheels at the back. That seems to be, we're doing an awful lot of repairs to the balance of the wheelchairs, the brakes, and just the general running repairs that you really need on wheelchairs and equipment like that, yeah.
And presumably some of them are pretty complicated. And do you think there is an argument that people perhaps from developed countries have something of an advantage over people from less developed countries in terms of the equipment they've got and the technology involved in it?
I don't think it's an advantage. It's a distinct... You have to draw the line between what's used in competition and what's used in daily use. And an awful lot of the equipment that we've been repairing is actually daily use. The competition repairs that we've done, like you said earlier on your little introduction there, a lot of the rules and regulations are governed by the IPC, and as such we have to comply, as all the teams do, to those rulings.
And do you think there is a risk, though, that the games become a little bit more about technology and the focus is more at the moment on the blades used by Oscar Pistorius and his rival yesterday and not perhaps as much as it should be about the amazing human achievement behind it?
That's right. I mean, these sort of stories pop up during every Paralympic, and even through during the ordinary Olympics, you get your controversy coming up. And that is really as much as I can say about it. We work within the rules of the IPC, and that ongoing argument has to be done within those official boundaries.
Absolutely. And do you think there have been big changes, though, in the games? They've got a sort of 60-odd year history. Anything striking about what we're seeing now and things that we might not have seen perhaps 6 decades back in terms of the technology in the games?
Oh, the technology, sure. I mean, the running blades have been around a considerable length of time. I mean, the controversy at the moment is over the length of those blades, not the design. The design of the blades has been around a long time. Similarly, you get this in cycling. The bikes are really sophisticated now, so that technology has moved on. But as the technology moves on, so does the athlete on the top of any of this equipment or any participant. The whole regime, the whole sports science behind pushing people's abilities, no matter what medical condition they have, is certainly improved. And that's where the great improvements are.
Now, Ken, in the days ahead, is there any one sport that you're particularly worried about in terms of the workload that's about to come your way or in terms of the complicated nature of the repairs that are likely to land on your desk, so to speak?
Well, again, the wheelchair rugby guys have already been frequent visitors to us, as have the tennis guys. Lots of punctures going on there. We've got the big climax coming up to the basketball arena. So, but all our welders are on hand and all on site in case anything pops up. That's the main concern. All the other repairs that we're doing, we've got excellent technicians. Really, really, I wanted to say how strongly I do say that, is that our technicians have been working absolutely tremendously well on some equipment that we've had to do a lot of repairs to, but I speak very, very highly of their ability, that's for sure.
And we speak very highly of yours, Ken. Ken Hurst, the technical director of the 2012 Paralympic Workshop, doing an amazing job there. And this next song should be called 200% for the dedication there by Ken and his team, but it's actually called 110%. It's by Jesse Ware. And that was 110% by Jesse Ware. And in the next half hour of the programme, how will François Hollande's alleged love triangle affect his political career? Also, Monocle's Steve Bloomfield speaks to the author Jerry Broughton about the meaning of maps. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news.
Thanks very much. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said today that China and its neighbours in Southeast Asia must move determinedly to draw up a code of conduct to help resolve disputes in the South China Sea. Clinton was visiting Indonesia ahead of a trip to China on Tuesday and said she would tell Beijing and other claimants that it was essential to get faltering diplomacy back on track and move towards a deal as soon as possible. A 15-year-old Dutch boy has been sentenced to a year in juvenile detention today for stabbing a girl to death, a girl whose Facebook post reportedly led to a contract for her killing. The case, known in Holland as the Facebook murder, caused widespread debate about the role of social media in violent crime. The head of the International Committee of the Red Cross will begin a visit to Syria today and will hold talks with President Bashar al-Assad to try to improve humanitarian access to civilians in the war-torn country. Some of the 270 South African miners charged with the murder of their 34 colleagues after a violent clash with police last month have arrived at court today ahead of their release from jail as the government attempts to reassure investors. And the chief representative of the Economist Group has said that Europe's muted economic growth will affect Asia, despite major Asian economies like China, Japan and South Korea increasing spending or lowering lending rates in an attempt to counter the negative impact of Europe's debt crisis. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. It is 32 minutes past six in the evening here in London, 32 minutes past seven in Paris. That's where we're going to be heading now, because all along the campaign trail, France's president of not much more than 100 days promised to give the French people a break from all the gossip and the glamour which surrounded Nicolas Sarkozy and his one-time supermodel wife. François Hollande said he just wanted to be plain old Mr. Normal. But two books have been published across the channel in the past couple of weeks, shedding new light on Hollande's personal life, painting a rather different picture of that life and a bitter tug of war for his affections between the two women at his side and the woman who is the mother of his children. Well, to tell us more about it, we're joined by the French journalist and former head of France 24, Christine O'Krent. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. Now, not too much of a surprise, perhaps, for the French people that Valérie Trivière and Ségolène Royal are not exactly the best of friends.
Well, Tom, of course not, but, you know, it's quite, how could I put it? There's nothing new under the sun. I mean, it's quite seldom in a way that the first four and the second companion get along well. And of course, in this particular circumstances where politics has been prevailing, it's a very banal story, which is only heightened by the fact that Ségolène Royal ran for president, and she was, of course, beaten by Sarkozy, but she did gather as much as more than 47% of French voters. And at the time where Hollande had already walked out on her for that other woman who happens to be a journalist. And, I mean, it happens in again, it's a very banal story. Would it not be for such political circumstances, all these people who now write about that wouldn't try and sell their books? I mean, you know, that's it.
But Christine, one of the things that I think people who've read the book are particularly surprised about, particularly the book Entre Deux Feux, is the lengths that these two women are said to have gone to in order to have, won the affection of François Hollande.
Well, I mean, who would have said so, that François Hollande is such a seductive guy? But after all, you know, Ségolène Royal and François Hollande met when they were at school together in that ENA, which is the sort of high-powered school for the French elite. They were both politically ambitious. She actually got ahead of him as she became a member of government under François Mitterrand, and he didn't. And he was making his way in the Socialist Party and eventually became the leader of the Socialist Party. But it was quite an extraordinary couple in the sense that they were both driven by the same political ambition. And then as it happened in life, I mean, he fell in love for somebody else and Ségolène didn't like that. And of course, Valérie Trierweiler, who is a journalist for Paris Match, didn't really like and still doesn't like the idea that Hollande had a life before he actually met her. And of course, the fact that Valérie Trierweiler really misbehaved in a way during the campaign and after Hollande was elected, especially with that story that she tweeted her support for the candidate who was actually running against Ségolène Royal in a local election. Of course, it all added pepper and salt to the old wounds.
But is there a feeling go ahead, sorry.
Please.
Is there a feeling in France that the two women, one of them has been more graceful perhaps than the other in the handling of these various alleged scandals and perhaps not alleged scandals? Who of the two has been perhaps more graceful and handled things in the eyes of the French electorate, perhaps in the more graceful manner?
Well, let's say that one seems to be more jealous than the other. But as you said very, very rightly in the beginning, you know, after Sarkozy, this new presidency had promised us, you know, no gossip, no high style, nothing. Well, there's not much style, but there's a lot of gossip. But the gossip, there's nothing new there. It's just a rather banal story of love and jealousy and rivalry between two women who, after all, have rather different fates. I mean, Ségolène Royal did run for President of the Republic, and Valérie Trévelet is a journalist. I mean, she used to be a journalist. I think it's quite difficult for her to keep at her, I mean, to stick to her job, although she's been trying very hard to do so. But again, I don't think it has much political impact. It just makes up for a lot of gossip, which I'm sure the normal president would very well, I mean, would be keen to be without.
I mean, in the old days, if I think back to the time of François Mitterrand, such a book would not only have attracted no interest, it would have simply not been written in the first place. Do you think there's been a bit of a shift in attitudes in France as far as the treatment of people in the public eye?
I wouldn't say so. Remember the extraordinary story of Mitterrand's daughter. And sort of second marriage or second family life, which was kept a state secret for as long as Mitterrand was at the Élysée. And then it came out, and Mitterrand actually moved in such a way he actually wanted the story to come out. But there has always been, contrary to Britain, there has always been in France, you know, we have no tabloids to speak of. And so there's always been more respect and more privacy, in a way, for politicians than in Britain, frankly. And it's changing because, again, people are now eager for such stories more than before, and also, you know, with all these electronic devices, everybody can say anything about anybody and take a picture, and it's on the web. So times are changing, but again, I think the French, to the French, it's fairly new in that respect.
Indeed. And of course, after the Dominic Strauss-Kahn story and everything else, perhaps there's a new appetite emerging in France for a bit of information about what's going on behind closed doors. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, Christine Krent, the former head of France 24. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a look at the history of maps.
A bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Bears.
You are cordially invited to tune into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
On the latest edition, we get some cultural offerings from the Venice Architecture Biennale, and test our fortunes with a unique character from the old American fairground.
It's fascinating to see school-aged children just look up and wonder what she's going to say.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Marseille, renowned for its multicultural makeup and hard edges, is a city being reshaped. To discover the beating heart of Marseille, Monocle Films visits three hoteliers who reflect the evolution of this heady Mediterranean city: Au Vieux Panier, Le Petit Nice, and Hotel Le Corbusier.
I always used to say that we are here to share our passion. Here we are so proud of the building, so emotionally attached to the work of Le Corbusier that we are proud of it and we want to share it.
Marseille in Motion, Monocle Films on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. It's 42 minutes past six in the evening. Now, throughout history, maps have shaped our view of the world and our place in it. In his new book, A History of the World in 12 Maps, the author Jerry Broughton argues that far from being purely scientific objects, maps are unavoidable, subjective, and bound up with the systems of power that created them. Well, a little earlier on, Monocle's Steve Bloomfield spoke to Broughton, and he started by asking him, why is it that people love old maps so much?
I think both. We want to know where we've come from and where we're going. And I think maps, of course, historically have done both those things. They partly address that question. We think that our great existential question is, who am I? But I think the map says, where am I? And where am I is also a sort of very existential question. It's, where am I in the world? Where have I come from? And where am I going? And of course, maps, even from today's online maps, answer that question. You know, when you go onto Google, what's the first thing you do? You find your home. You go to where you come from, and from then you map around it, and then you think, oh, I'll go and look at China, or I'll go and look at somewhere else. So it's about saying, where am I on the map in the world? And I also think, you know, it's very much that sense of a location-finding device. I mean, we think that a map just crudely gets you from A to B, and it does that. But it does that in so many different ways. It does it in an online way. You know, you look about, you know, where's the nearest Chinese restaurant? Oh, you get a map online and you find where it is. But it's also that sense it orientates you, it grounds you. And of course, another, I think, funny thing is that people keep saying, you know, alpha males or alpha people generally always want to have the map. If you're traveling with a group of people, who's the person who wants to get the map? And that's because there's a sense in which you want to define where you're going.
Is that also because there's always historically been a sense of power from being the person that has the knowledge of where we are and what's going on in the world?
Yeah, I mean, the early parts of the book look at things like Babylonian and Greek maps, which are very much about an elite saying, we can create the world. You know, when you're drawing maps on stone, as some of them are, or wood or papyrus, the craft that's involved in that is obviously very expensive, very elite. So Babylonian imperial and Greek imperial culture is about saying, we can create those maps. Often they're shown in very public places. And they are sort of semi-mystical objects. It's saying to the culture who sees it, we need to accept that whoever's produced this has some godlike authority over the world and how it's being created. And of course, that runs right throughout history. If you think about the way in which maps are being used in the Renaissance in terms of trade, discovery and exploration, it's how they're being used in the 18th and 19th century around the development of the nation state and the way that nations are being surveyed. And of course, right through to today, the way in which Apple and Google are now having such a fight over online map applications, as Apple now challenges Google, because the stakes are incredibly high. It's about who controls a map of the internet. And that's a very, very powerful and very lucrative business.
And going back from the 15th century through to the 19th, when people were exploring the world and coming back to Europe then at a time with, this is what I found and this is what we've done, how important were cartographers then in essentially proving this is where we are right now, and we're the guys who found it all?
It's really important, because what we need to remember is that this is a period where people go abroad for 2 or 3 years and they come back and people don't even recognise them. It's that fear of travel. Travel is a fearful thing in the classical and early periods. And so a map is a way of basically showing people where you've been, and it sort of insulates them from the dangers that they faced, and it says, we've come back, and magically we bring back the route. I mean, you know, the whole treasure map conceit is something which is very powerful, even for the Renaissance period, where people are saying, this is how the world is starting to change and evolve, and these are the riches, and these are how you can gain access to it. You know, there's a lovely story about how the Italians send a guy who's trading in horses to Lisbon in 1502, and what this guy does, he's called Cantino, he goes, and he bribes a Portuguese mapmaker to give him the map that shows the Spice Islands in 1502, and he takes it back to northern Italy, and it's stayed there ever since. And the map is now called the Cantino map, or Cantino planisphere. And all the letters are about, it magically shows us access to the riches of the East. The map really has it all. The map sums it all up. So that really is about the power of the map, yeah.
Who were, you know, the greatest mapmakers?
I'm slightly biased because my period is the Renaissance. I mean, I think that that moment from the late 15th, early 16th century, where particularly the Portuguese are mapping the New World, the Americas, and the East, going east and discovering Southeast Asian archipelago and the Spice Islands, is an extraordinary moment. So for me, that period of Iberian mapping in Spain and Portugal is extraordinary, because you go really from, if you look at a world map in about 1400, it's completely unrecognisable. Mm. If you look at a map just 100 years later, any school kid could say, that's the world as we understand it. So in just under 100 years, the world as we know it has completely transformed. And no other period in history goes through that intensive kind of mapping.
And is that because of what it was they were discovering, to use that phrase, or the way that they were then actually drawing the maps?
It's a good question. It's almost as though the two come together, because, of course, it's a period where mapmakers are recovering classical Greek or Roman traditions of mapping, so they're using mathematics, so they're becoming much more sophisticated in how they map. And it's about saying, we're suddenly travelling outside of Europe and we're discovering new places, so we need some way of recording how to get back to them. And of course, the map is the perfect object to do that. So it's a synergy between these two things, an inherited tradition and the urgent need for a new kind of technology that is what the map represents in this period.
You've been talking about Google and Apple and how we use maps now. Do you worry at all that we're losing something when it comes to maps now? The fact that it's all online, it's all digital, it's touchscreen, it's not a piece of paper that someone's written on?
I'm not sure that we're losing something, because what the book says is that maps have always gone through these crises. So the book starts with a Babylonian stone map, and it goes through papyrus maps, and then it goes into paper maps in manuscript, and then through print. Your manuscript to print is almost as profound a moment in terms of how people get excited but also worried about maps as we're now experiencing today. So the shift from the paper map to the digital online map. I don't think it's that things get lost, because I think that's just the nature of maps, that they are able to mutate in different ways through different media. I think what worries me is the fact that for the first time ever, we've got a concentration of online mapping within one or two companies, particularly Google, who basically have a 70% stake in the online search area. And with that comes their maps. And with that comes the advertising they want to put on those maps. And so I think for the first time, we've got a situation where online companies are monopolizing and shaping the map of the future. That is my worry. It's not that we lose the paper map. It's that we've always, in past histories, had diversities of world maps. We've never really had one. Even, you know, Mercator's famous projection isn't as predominant as people often say. There were all kinds of different projections that were being used throughout history and before and after Mercator. So we've always had a diversity. So I welcome, actually, what hopefully will happen with Apple and other online companies challenging Google's monopoly, because at the moment it is actually looking like a monopoly. But I do think it's a really exciting and extraordinary moment for the map. The map is going through this incredible mutation, but certainly the paper map's dead. I don't mourn that, but I do worry about what kind of map we might get if we don't have diversity online.
And that was Jerry Broughton, the author of A History of the World in 12 Maps, speaking to Monocle's Steve Bloomfield. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in just a moment.
The September issue of Monocle is a global survey of flashpoints and fighting forces. In this inaugural defence-themed issue, our editors put on their flak jackets and pop on their helmets as they investigate everything from how to create a modern fighting force to how to design state-of-the-art camouflage. And we have lots more to offer too.
In the affairs section, we climb on board the USS George Washington to see why aircraft carriers still rule the waves. We head to Norway to visit the world's best officer training school. And I nip over to Brussels to interview Anders Fogh Rasmussen, Secretary General of NATO.
In the business section this month, we go inside the studios of America's leading camouflage designers. We take a look at the big businesses that have surprising defence interests, and we report on the major deals taking place at Farnborough this year. We also have our first entrepreneur's guide, a comprehensive look at how to set up shop.
The Battle Ready September issue of Monocle is on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Burgess Watson, here on Monocle 24. It's just after 10 to 7 in the evening here in London, which means it's 10 to 8 in Naples, which is where we're heading next, because Monocle's managing editor David Michon is there for the sixth session of the World Urban Forum, which kicked off this weekend. That's a forum that was established by the United Nations to examine one of the most pressing problems facing the world today, which is, of course, rapid urbanisation and its impact on communities, cities, economies, climate change and policies. So fill us in, David, how are things there in Naples?
Well, it's very good. I mean, the conference has been going on for a couple of days, but today was the kind of official opening ceremony, and that was kind of a collection of Italian politicians, including the mayor of Naples and Juan Clos, who is the executive director of UN Habitat, who opened the forum and kind of set the agenda. And it really, you know, what people are talking about really comes off the back of Rio Plus 20, which is the kind of concept of sustainability. And at Rio Plus 20, you know, cities were a major focus at that conference there. And so this is kind of taking a look at the same issues, but from, you know, the other side of things, from the perspective of mayors and policymakers in cities.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that Naples has been playing host to this conference, because many people would say Naples is a city where perhaps urban planning and infrastructure are areas that need quite a lot of work.
Yes, that's true. I mean, it is kind of a crumbling city. But, you know, in fact, there's a lot of interesting things happening in the world of cities in Italy. The national government is on the brink of a project to create 10 new megacities. So to kind of put the larger metropolis together of Naples, so which is a city of 900,000, but after kind of this conglomeration, it would be a city of 3 million. So it's quite a switch in the way they're planning to operate in terms of building their infrastructure and managing the city, and hopefully drawing in resources from the areas around it.
And what's the mood been like at that forum? Is there a lot of optimism that these tasks are tasks that can be dealt with, or is there a sense that some of these challenges are insurmountable?
No, I mean, there is quite a lot of optimism. The perspective of people at the city level is really that cities are kind of gaining autonomy and strength as people are urbanizing. You know, cities have a much stronger voice, even compared to national governments. So they're starting to speak out for kind of, you know, issues that they care about and starting to take a stand even internationally about those things.
Dave.
So there's a great deal of kind of sense of potential in that.
Good. Well, you mentioned that a little earlier on you'd spoken to Juan Clos, who is the executive director of UN Habitat, and he seems to think there's more than one way to solve the problem of rapid urbanization. Let's take a listen.
We are proposing two lines of advance. One is the elaboration of national urban policy as an instrument that the cabinet, the Council of Ministers, has the opportunity to think where is going my population to be in 10 years' time. Population is moving, we know that. Then where is our population going to be in 10, 15 years, and what are we going to do about that? This is one point, that line that we advocate. And the other line that we advocate at local line, at local level, sorry, is the, you know, to move the cities to do planet city extensions. Because we know that they know that their cities are going to grow. Their cities are going to grow in any case, either if they do anything or if they don't do anything, then it's better to plan. And if you have a a single penny, the priority in our point of view is to plan. Otherwise, than planet urbanization, it's always very difficult to correct afterwards. And those are the two lines of advancement that we are proposing. One is to influence the cabinet in order to try to elaborate a simple but consistent national urban policy, and to also move the cities towards a well-planned, well-thought city extensions.
And that was Johan Kloss, the executive director of UN Habitat, speaking to David Michon, who we were also speaking to just there from Naples. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24, your episode.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24. The Blue
Pajalabad. Monocle 24.
This is 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 Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Well, up next here on Monocle 24 after the news is this week's episode of The Culture Show. Let's get a listen to what's in store for us.
But when it comes to really knocking out creative ideas, I find I have to be almost in a state of extreme tranquility or boredom. So I have the sensitivity to the vague subtleness of most creative ideas, because the good ideas don't hit you like a hammer. They kind of creep almost like a distracting thought at the edge of your other conscious, more intelligent thoughts.
And that was an illustrator from Australia talking about where he gets his inspiration from. So you'll have to listen to that show to find out all the details there. Well, that's all we've got time for today. Thanks to our producer, Hannah Jenkins, and our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Up next, of course, we've got Culture. And in 3 hours' time, at 22 hours at London time, Tyler Brulé and Hugo MacDonald will be back for the Monocle Daily. Well, Tyler will be back also for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Do stay tuned.